You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is March 3rd, 2023. Hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. Bhavin, it's been a couple weeks, as per usual. Yep. Although I've talked to you before then. Anyway, what's going on with you? What have you been up to?
I don't know, man. I'm just heads down into work. So Pure Storage has sales kickoff next week. So it's all getting ready for it and working on my presentations and labs and things like that. So keeping busy. And as you can see, I've been lazy enough. I still need a haircut, even though I fly out in 2 days. And then I know we keep talking about like the blind that I need to put on that window.
Because you bought it, did you not? Right?
Yeah, I have it. I've had it for, I think, 4 weeks at this point. But it's just about like, I don't know, drilling a couple of holes in that window pane and then putting those blinds on. But yeah, I have been lazy. How about you, Ryan? What's going on?
Yeah, it's all good. I've had a blind up. You can't see my window since I moved in here. Yeah. It's a great blind, I will admit. Did it myself. Very proud of it.
Nice.
If I seem slow down, I'm recovering from being sick. Got the coof. Shout out to Tim there for the third time. And this time I had I couldn't taste, which was a weird sensation. I mean, people often talked about that. Never happened to me until this time. I feel like first few times it was basically like I had allergies. I barely even noticed. This time it was strange. I had vertigo and it's been a rough week. So recovering, catching up, those kind of things. I also did, I changed one of my summer plans, which I'm always looking forward to. I was supposed to go out on this big trip to the Midwest, and I decided after planning it that 8 days in my car alone was not something I wanted to do. Okay. I was very okay with it for quite a long time. Even if I drove like even longer, it'd be like 3 days in the car for an event that is 3 nights, 4 days. So it's like half the trip in the car. Like,
not to worry.
And then I was, exactly. And then I was convincing someone to go with me on this trip. And I actually had them pretty hooked. Yeah. And then they convinced me like, hey, we have this other thing in our backyards in the Northeast. And it winds up that we're going to do this 10-day 1400 mile trip from New York to Maine over the summer. And we're doing that instead of me driving out there. And this time I get to hang out with my buddy, get to do it. Nice. You know, get to be sort of in it the entire time, closer to home. I think it's overall a better choice driving cross country.
Yeah. Driving 8 days on your own, not a fun plan.
I do wish to do that one day though. And maybe like with the whole family and like a camper or something like that, like the typical thing that, you know, we'll do. I feel like there's so much to see in the U.S., especially in the Midwest. I have spent very little time out there. So
I think during 2020, a guy I used to follow on Twitter, I still am, but he rented an RV or something like that and basically drove from North Carolina through all the national parks, went to Washington, and then came back. Washington State, not DC, because that's not a fun trip. Exactly. Went all across the country, hitting all the different national parks and did a loop back. So that did sound a lot of fun.
Yeah, a lot of people rented and did those in 2020. I remember I looked to do it in a short period of time in 2020, or even maybe it was 21. And like everything was rented out because everybody did it.
And if you really want to get a kick, I think if you do a YouTube search, I think The Daily Show with Trevor Noah did a clip about how novice people rented RVs and didn't know how to operate them on freeways, tried to take exits like the ramps that they would usually do in their car, yeah. and like boom, yeah. everything was toppling over. So yeah.
Well, I mean, they will rent you and just send you on your way. Yeah, without much.
As long as you have insurance. Like,
you ever rent a giant U-Haul truck and you're in this thing like, I shouldn't be driving this thing. That's how I feel like you feel. Anyway, yeah, so that's, I'm looking forward to that. Other than that, I'm looking forward to this weekend. Got some snow coming, but gonna chill, I think, at home. I was gonna head to New York and visit some family, but with 9 or so inches of snow potentially, probably not.
Well, I'm glad you're doing better. Like,
yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, I am too. It's like, especially it was break here, so like, you know, I couldn't fully enjoy it anyway.
Gotcha.
Small potatoes. The show for this this week is Bhavin and I. You know, you haven't had a show with just Bhavin and I in quite some time. We like to do these every now and then, mix it in. And today is going to be about what is serverless. Going back to school, we like to kind of dive into topics, do sort of a mile wide, foot deep episode on what certain topics are. We actually are doing this on purpose. We have a couple guests lined up that are going to touch on some of these topics. So it feels appropriate. And but before we dive into that, we're going to do a little bit of news. We have a few things going on. Bhavin, why don't you kick us off?
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, sure. This week, over the last couple of weeks, we saw acquisitions and pivots from startups. So just talking about a couple of things. I think one of the vendors in our ecosystem, our friends at OnDart, got acquired by Akamai. And I know, and I think this news just broke out yesterday. So I know when we met the senior principal engineer at KubeCon, I forgot his name, that works for Linode, and how they want to build out the whole Kubernetes ecosystem and these edge deployments. Sorry?
Steven
Rust. Yes, thank you. and how they wanted to build these managed services out and at these edge locations and CDNs and offer it as a service. I think OnDAT fits right in, like as that storage layer. So good for the people at OnDAT that now have a new, bigger home and can have a bigger impact with the footprint that Akamai has already.
Yeah. Absolutely. I know OnDAT was one of those players when we first, you know, were in this sort of ecosystem with Portworx before we ever, you know, were at Pure and things like that. And we were, you know, always close and in touch with what they were doing. And now, you know, it's just exciting to see, you know, all these players that entered 5 or 6 years ago coming out on top. Obviously, not everybody can. So it's really good to see everyone over on that join a bigger family. And yeah, excited to see what I think Akamai is doing. A lot of cool things, especially like you said with Linode and what they're doing with Kubernetes. I think I read an article recently that was like it compared all the Kubernetes services out there, and Linode's was like the fastest.
Ooh, nice.
To like bootstrap Kubernetes cluster. So a little
well, good job, Steven, I guess. No, and to your point, right, like there were so many vendors. I don't think there are any more independent Kubernetes storage vendors out there, like Portworx.
There are, there definitely are. We talked about a few recently, but I feel like they came in after.
Oh, after the first wave, I guess. I think the first wave on that is now Akamai. Robin is now Rakuten. Maya Data got acquired by DataCore. Portworx by Pure Storage. So, like the first wave is kind of gone. Now we have the newer vendors, I guess.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Nice. And then second, like after talking about acquisition, just wanted to highlight a pivot from one of the startups. And we had these people or the CTO for ContainIQ on the podcast to talk about eBPF and give us a one-on-one overview of what eBPF is. They have decided to do a pivot and start a new content generation company or things like that. Again, I don't clearly understand what they are pivoting to, but it's just that I don't know what happened, but ContainIQ has a new future, which is not public yet. So they did like obviously transition the customers off to somebody else. We're waiting for those news, but ContainIQ went through a pivot. So if you are looking for the one thing I really liked about them is how they created such a huge base of Kubernetes 101 articles, right? Like they had these native searches going on their website and they had a lot of useful information. So we'll definitely miss that. But again, congrats to, the co-founders on a successful pivot, and now they can continue doing what they love.
Absolutely.
And then the final article was around Red Hat and how it now open sourced the project, or not open source, but donated the project Kepler to CNCF. So Kepler has been around for a while, and what it does is it uses eBPF, again tying it back to eBPF, I guess, and then uses eBPF layer CPU performance counters and some machine learning models to estimate the power consumptions for your workloads that are running on that Kubernetes cluster. So it shows you a time series data, and you can actually take these metrics and create awesome Grafana dashboards and then show how much power your containers, pods, namespaces, or different compute nodes in the Kubernetes cluster are consuming. And Kepler can also help you like take smarter orchestration or provisioning decisions. So like if you wanted to provision workloads on nodes that are not as carbon footprint intensive, you can do that using Kepler and the Kubernetes scheduler. So interesting project that I came across. I just wanted to share it with the ecosystem. If one of the organizational priorities you have today is making sure you track your carbon footprint, Kepler can be the tool that helps you with that.
Cool, absolutely.
That's it for news for me.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Cool. I had just one here, which was, you know, we've been following the story of sort of Red Hat and IBM kind of coming together. That sort of happened. I believe that was the end of 2022.
It was.
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, they've been putting a lot of effort into sort of, you know, their Open Data Foundation and their Ceph products, and really kind of pushing that whole thing. This article is really about how sort of the Spectrum line, IBM Spectrum, is now renamed to IBM Storage, but it's not just a rename. They're doing a lot of stuff underneath that. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm understanding it, they're sort of simplifying what they're offering underneath that name. Part of which is sort of that, you know, data AI hybrid, which is, you know, does include Ceph and what's in the Red Hat portfolio, but then it also includes the Fusion products from IBM. And I think it's just a way for, like, obviously Red Hat and IBM are both pretty big companies. So I think this is sort of a natural thing we're going to see, is sort of like as they figure out their portfolio, things are going to change. I don't hate the name, you know, but I don't hate simplifications, especially when you have a pretty complex portfolio with Red Hats and IBM. So exciting to see. I know, you know, we're always a big fan of ODF and what OpenShift and Red Hat has been doing there. So, you know, cool to see how they're starting to integrate it all.
Yeah.
But if you're interested, go take a look at, you know, what that means and if you want to go read about it.
And I think I like your point, right? Like, as long as it simplifies things, that's perfect. Like, there was a lot of confusion in how ODF and Spectrum and all of these different storage portfolios work together. So I like this too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, in a complex, multi-layered landscape like we are always living in, simplification is an underrated thing to do when you're living in a world of abstractions.
Yep.
Speaking of abstractions, let's talk about serverless.
That's an awesome segue, dude.
First, let's talk about the name serverless and what it actually means. Do you want to kick us off there?
Yeah, sure. So serverless computing, I think when the word was first introduced, there was a lot of pushback around, like, there are actually servers there.
There's still pushback.
I know. I think whenever you talk about serverless, that's the first disclaimer that you have to give to the listeners. Like, okay, yes.
Yeah.
Everybody knows there are servers there. It's just about the management, as you rightly pointed out. Like, it's about the abstraction. Like, am I the one who is responsible for managing those servers? If I'm not, then it's serverless for me. Like I'm just worried about how my applications are running or how do I deploy my applications. I don't really care about what the infrastructure stack looks like. So I think that's like a good overview of, for me, for what serverless is in just like one line.
Yeah, I mean, should we call it managementless? You know? Like really, every article you read will say something along the lines of this is what serverless is, but lo and behold, you know, things are still running on the server somewhere. Yeah. You just do not have to be aware of it. And the way I kind of like think about it is, you know, you almost have to go, because we're living in this Kubernetes cloud native world, and this is what this podcast is really about. If we take a step back and think about how, you know, servers were pets, servers were provisioned, your application was put on and you had to manage it, to think about it. This is really a sort of an extension of now, okay, you can send your application off to run somewhere and not have to worry about the rest of it. Right. I feel like it's often conflated because we're living in this Kubernetes world of like, we deal with infrastructure a lot, right? And you're like, well, you can't just run without servers. it's a valid point. Yeah. And whoever came up with this name, like, great buzzword, terrible buzzword. And maybe there's like a top 10 worst buzzwords of all time. Ooh. This would be towards the top in my list, personally. I hate the term, but it is used a lot. And so we have to be comfortable with, you know, what it means by that. And really, you know, it just really means that you're not managing the servers that the thing is running on. And there's a lot of more to that detail. So when we're going into serverless and we talk about that real servers are still being used, but developers don't need to be aware of them. Let's talk about some of the, like, why would you use this? What are the benefits?
Yeah, for sure. I think we already covered, like, there are no servers to provision or manage part. But one of the key benefits that serverless brings to the table is you never pay for idle resources, right? Your application can truly scale down to zero if there is no one asking for, like, if there are no API calls being made to that piece of application code, it can actually go down to zero. And then it can scale up as more user traffic is being generated and more resources are being needed by that application. So it scales with usage, which basically means that you'd never pay for idle resource consumption. So it allows you to just have your application code submitted. And then whenever your web app or your users want to interact with it through, let's say, an HTTP request, that's when the application code is spun up on a container or on whatever a micro VM or whatever the cloud provider who's offering these service, right, wants to run your application code in. So it allows you to scale with usage.
Yeah, and there are some like caveats to that. Mm-hmm. I think in research and in hearing about how people are actually using it, you know, some of the benefits are if you're using it at such an enormous scale, some of those benefits can, you know, start to wean in the sense that if you're running enough serverless functions, you're effectively are using an entire server, right? Whereas the initial benefit of like you're just running what you need, which I do like the analogy of, like if you're paying for a cell phone plan and only use some of your data, right? That whole concept versus just paying for what you are using. The idea behind the service is you just kind of like send off your thing and it's paying for sort of the CPU cycles and memory it's using at the time of instantiation. But yeah, I have heard sort of horror stories of like, you know, it's another way for cloud to make money and all that kind of things. I can't speak from personal experience. Yeah. If you can, we'd love to hear from you. But I know there are some caveats to it in the sense that there are still, you know, you still want to make sure it's right for what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Right. And so kind of taking that, you know, how the future will look and how you're planning on using it at what scale, you could get into that. But generally, if you're using it as intended, I think at a reasonable scale, you're going to definitely find that sort of cost because you're sort of just renting space, right? Instead of entire server.
It also helps you like reduce your operational overhead, right? I think in my previous job, I was responsible for a lab that I built for other teammates to use. And since it was I who provisioned it and was responsible for managing it, there were a lot of things that included like updates. So starting from the BIOS and XCC level on the servers itself, the OS level, applying patches whenever needed, then the virtualization tier. Again, there was a lot of work involved, right? And obviously, like if you just want to run your app, you don't want to think about all of these. given, like, there are some of these challenges were already solved by cloud computing. But then if you're running EC2 instances, maybe you have to patch those EC2 instances as well. So this is taking right. that level of abstraction one layer ahead or above and just allowing you to focus on your application code. And
And I think we have the bullet point here, simplified backend code. Yeah. You'll probably see that in a bunch of articles. And and really that just means that, like, instead of writing all the code to instantiate an entire server to serve maybe a particular function in the backend code, you might be able to just write that function, yeah. hand it off to the serverless platform. We'll talk more about platforms and like what you get out of them. But you'll hand it off and it'll just serve it from an API endpoint, right? So you don't have to actually build all that around whatever your code is doing, whatever that bit of compute that you need is doing. It kind of handles a lot of that for you. So like technically you're reducing the amount of stuff you have to care about and write yourself. That being said, right, the natural question I think is there is sort of this question around lock-in in the sense that I don't think there's like a standard sort of interface for serverless functions or serverless code that works across cloud providers or anything like that.
It doesn't, right? But I think that's what we'll talk about in the later half of the podcast, where projects like Knative, like, so if you're running Kubernetes, projects like Knative gives you that standardized interface to run serverless functions anywhere you want. But yeah, if you're talking about things like AWS Lambda or Azure Functions or Google Cloud Functions, there isn't that real uniform layer that can allow you to take a Lambda and then run it on Azure Functions, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the last bullet I had here was just like the overall efficiency, right? If you're only focusing on stuff that matters, technically your devs can focus on what matters, et cetera. All those fancy sounding things. I'll say that, you know, serverless is often sort of touted as like, oh, well, you know, just throw serverless at it, you know? Again, we're a proponent of using the right tool for the right job.
Yep.
I think we've talked about that many times on this podcast, especially in the context of, you know, Kubernetes or even in the Wasm episode, I believe. So it really begs to do the research of like, okay, here's what serverless is. Here's what it's supposed to give you. Does it fit what I'm trying to do? And hopefully we'll have some guests on that can talk to that exact point. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And so forth. So we have a few drawbacks here. I can kick it off with the first one, which is the concept of sort of cold and warm start, right? There's a lot of articles out there that talk about cold starts, warm starts, how serverless has this sort of an inherent problem of cold start. There's people out there that say, like, hey, let's stop talking about this because it's just like it's a edge case and it's used as a scapegoat for like why not to use serverless. And then there's a lot of people out there that like, it's mostly been solved, etc. But the idea as a cold start is in serverless, you don't own your servers, you don't own your compute. So you're not putting your application out there and it's not sitting there waiting, you know, for a request to come in for it to be used all the time. Necessarily. After a certain point sort of time, there's sort of a an initial spin up time. If that serverless endpoint hasn't been used for a while, it may go dormant because it's essentially rented space. So if it is going to be used after some time, it sort of has to become ready and then be used. So there's a lag, basically. Certain platforms are better at instantiating than others. I'm sure there's differences between those platforms, but the idea of a cold start is that's what you're getting to. You know, that's a potential issue versus a warm start is the thing's ready for you to use and it'll respond right away.
Yeah, and so put this in terms of like people that are using virtual machines today, right? Like your VM is always running. And that's why whenever a request comes in, you have your application ready to respond.
Yep.
But then let's say if you had cold start problems in VMs, obviously VMs have a much larger footprint, but the time it takes for the VMs to actually boot up and then the application to be up and running is the cold start issue. That's the timeline, right? Like you need your underlying orchestration layer to make sure that your application is ready to serve code. And that's the same issue. It completely translates to how serverless works or how functions work.
Yeah. And I think it's become more of a prominent topic in serverless because you never have the ability to just always run the thing. I mean, there is, you know, a certain level of, you know, expectation for how that thing is available depending on the platform, but you never really own it yourself outright. So, you know, I think, again, this just comes back to what are you trying to accomplish? Yep. Right. Cold start may be really beneficial to you because you can scale down to zero. Right. Yep. I mean, if your primary objective is like potentially saving costs and cutting costs and using serverless in a very specific way, maybe cold start is like, you know, something you just deal with. You monitor, you kind of figure out which ones are the problems. But if you're going into it sort of blind and then this happens to you, I think figure it out again, understanding that it's a thing.
I think talking about use cases, right? I think let's use an example. So like, let's say I'm building a website which has the ability for you to upload your own photos and will give you different resolutions. Yeah. So your website front end shouldn't be serverless because if your website is taking too much time to load, your users might go to a different site or churn away from your application. But you don't need the backend components where once you upload that file, what happens is always online. So once a user accesses your application, uploads that image, that's when your function or your serverless function can be online, take that and they do all the backend processing. So that can be a possibility where you save on costs. I think one of the examples that I really loved in the early days, I think this was like 4 or 5 years back. I don't know if you remember this, Ryan, but Acloud Guru, right? They used to be a training platform for AWS users. So I did all three of my AWS certs through Acloud Guru. They were a completely serverless hosting platform. So obviously they didn't need their videos and the media players to be available all the time. Only when you log in and you hit play, you select a course and you hit play, that's when they spun up resources. It was a really interesting use case because they showed that they can save like $5 or $6 million a year just by using serverless functions instead of having EC2 instances be ready all the time for that use case. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think web is definitely where you see this a lot, maybe e-commerce, right? Those kind of things where, you know, there's certain, you know, sort of widgets or functions. When I say widget, I feel like an old person. No offense. You use the word widget a lot, but I like cringed a little bit when I said it. Anyway, you know, there's certain things that aren't used a lot on your website. Those are perfect examples. I think I see a lot of the examples in web most of the time. Anyway, the other thing is obviously you don't own a lot of the infrastructure, any of the infrastructure, so to speak. So you are giving sort of your trust to that vendor who owns sort of the security of all those things, which again, isn't always a bad thing. I think it depends on who you are, right? I feel like we come to this middle ground a lot on the show, but maybe just because, you know, there are a lot of use cases. If depends if you're working in the government or if you're working for a bank or if you're a startup, like there's obviously different requirements that you have, one of which you may be more or less comfortable handing over things like security or having the amount of input, those kind of things.
Yeah. So. But if you are just another organization that's using the cloud and using serverless, I think AWS has many more resources and smart people working for them, and they can spend that money to make sure the layers are secure than you with a team of three people can. So like shared security model obviously helps organizations who don't want to take in all of that additional work on their own.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think we've done enough from a high level to kind of explain what serverless is, what it isn't. And now we're going to dive, I think, into some of the offerings. And when we get into some of the offerings, maybe we'll tease out some details about like how that specific thing is used versus others. And we are going to talk, like I said, about Knative, serverless versus functions as a service. You've heard us say function a lot because it does surface up that way. Yeah. So we will touch on that. So let's kick it off. Why don't you go into some of the offerings that you put on here?
Yeah, for sure. So let's start by talking about, I think, one of the most popular ones, right? AWS Lambda. So Lambda has been around for a while. And I know people who have attended like Greenvents or AWS summits that are local to specific cities. You will have seen the serverless espresso demonstration where whenever you ask for a coffee, it like executes a bunch of functions and then eventually tells the barista what to make. Again, it's just a cool demo. But Lambda has been around for a while. They do have that cold start problem where whenever your function is triggered, it has to create a new execution environment. It has to download the code or your image and then have the runtime instantiated and then make sure that the initialization code is all ready to go. And after that is when your function is actually run on the execution environment. So there is an environment lifecycle, and there is the cold start piece of it. But again, I don't want to talk about like all the different benefits of Lambda. We kind of covered that with serverless, but I just wanted to cover like a couple of new things that were announced recently, right? So if you had learned about Lambda a while back and you were just like, still cold start, not an, I don't want to use it right now because it doesn't fit my use case. There are a couple of things that can change your mind. So one of those things is Snap Start. So it's called Lambda Snap Start. I don't know why I'm having issues saying that word, but what it does is whenever your function or serverless function gets triggered for the first time, it goes through that cold start process and then it takes a snapshot of that execution environment. So it's ready for that warm start. So whenever a second request comes in, it checks whether there is an already running execution environment. If it's not, it sees whether there is a snapshot that's available of that execution environment. And if there is, it basically goes ahead and starts running your code. So it really reduces the amount of time from a couple of seconds to like less than 100 milliseconds is what AWS says with the snap start functionality. And then if, again, there isn't a snapshot available, it will take a snapshot and then go through the cold start process again. But if you, so like, let's say you had 20 different streams of requests coming in for your function. The first one, without snap start functionality, all of those will go through the cold start issue. Like it will go through the same steps, but with snap start, only the first one will. And then for everything else, you'll have a snapshot of your execution environment ready to go, and you can start running your code. So it drastically reduces the amount of time that is spent on spinning things up. That was one of the things that was announced. I think the second thing was around Lambda function URLs. So What this means is usually if you're doing Lambda, you have to have different AWS components. Like maybe you have an API gateway resource running in front of your Lambda function. So the API gateway is able to take in requests. But now with Lambda function URLs, what you can do is if you have HTTP requests, right? There is a standard URL that AWS has created that you can use to access your functions. So if I go through my nodes, in specific time, okay, which I can't in time. Okay, yeah, it's it takes the URL ID, lambda-url, the region ID on AWS. So it basically gives you an endpoint directly to your function. So you don't need to create and pay for those additional AWS resources just to handle HTTP requests. So again, that's a cool feature, a cool way to make sure that the infrastructure provisioning is even less than what it used to be before. So those were a couple of things that I wanted to highlight when it comes to AWS Lambda.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I think the next thing I want to talk about was moving cloud providers, moving to Microsoft Azure. Again, Azure has a similar capability like Lambda with Azure Functions, and Google Cloud has the same thing with Google Cloud Functions. But I wanted to start moving the discussion a bit to Kubernetes and how, again, this is Kubernetes Bytes, right? So let's see how we can get some of these serverless capabilities where I'm not responsible for the infrastructure. Or in the case of Kubernetes, I don't want to write those manifest files or those YAML files. Can I just take my container image and have you run for that for me? That's what I think the first step for Azure Container Apps is. Again, it runs on AKS as that Kubernetes layer, but you are not responsible for creating that AKS cluster. You're not responsible for defining your deployment manifests and your service manifests and your storage manifests. You just give Azure Container Apps the container image that you want to run, and it dynamically creates the entire infrastructure for you. But again, going over the point of control that Ryan mentioned right in the previous section, where you won't have access to the AKS cluster, you won't be able to modify the service manifests, you won't be able to modify your deployment manifests. It's just taking your simple container image and then running it on a Kubernetes cluster. So you're still getting the benefits of Kubernetes, the scaling capabilities based on KEDA, the event-driven capabilities, all of those still exist, but you're not responsible for managing and maintaining the Kubernetes clusters. I think that's one of the things that sets apart the Azure service, right? Like you're getting the serverless functionality, but you are able to bring in those same container images you had to run on Kubernetes without actually managing the Kubernetes layer. And this is just one step. I don't think Microsoft recommends you to use this for all of your applications. This is just if you're getting started or if you have a really small code, a really small application that doesn't warrant its own Kubernetes cluster. You can use this function or use this feature and provide that capability to your end user.
Absolutely. And something is interesting about Azure and sort of their serverless concepts is, you know, as we mentioned before, it really just means that you're not caring about the physical server. And Azure actually has the concept of a serverless tier for databases as well. Yep. So if you look at Azure SQL database serverless, it's sort of a it almost feels like it conflicts with a lot of what we've already been talking about, but the idea is still the same. You're not managing the compute, and your database only runs when it needs to. So again, this means that the database will actually pause itself when it's dormant or not being used, and warm back up when it's kind of instantiated, you know, an event comes in that it needs to be accessed. Again, they call this, right, the serverless compute tier. It's really just another compute tier that you don't have to manage the compute. That's all that serverless is just thrown in there. Again, this is one of the examples I just kind of like hate the idea of, like, because I first I hear serverless database, I'm like, oh, how would that work? You know?
The database really just goes away. So every time you have to spin it up again.
And they do kind of go into scenario. If you look it up, like, they go into scenarios that's suited for this, meaning like if it's unpredictable usage and it has periods of inactivity, then it might be fine for this database to be like, oh, it needs to wake up and I'll serve you whatever data you need and then go back to sleep. And then, you know, that actually is a good use case for, you know, saving the cost instead of just the alternative, which is you boot up this SQL server, it runs all the time. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's only accessed on Wednesday nights every it's 3 months. Like, I don't know. Right. But the idea is like, that wouldn't make sense. Yeah, right. Yeah. So, again, this is another example of the term serverless used in a different way than, say, what we're talking about in sort of smaller sort of functions and stuff that we're about. And to I'm talk pretty about, sure. Or even more, or even compared to something like Lambda.
And I think I'm pretty sure we'll get a lot of comments on this. Like, AWS has the same thing. Like, AWS database managed services has that serverless tier where I think they call it Fargate or something like that. But yeah, I haven't done much research into the database serverless things. This episode is just focused on the compute layer, I guess. But there are similar offerings from cloud vendors.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same. I mean, we talk about databases on Kubernetes a lot here on this podcast. It's like, if you ran a database on Kubernetes and you scaled it down when it wasn't being used and you had some kind of API gateway that when you got a request and the database wasn't up, you'd spin it up, you'd serve the request, and then you'd spin it back down. Like, it's
don't
really all
give
that's
away
happening.
The Knative section. I think.
But again, just be aware of that when you see the term serverless, because it is super loaded and you know, one of the 10 reasons that Ryan doesn't like it. And okay, so moving on, you know, I have Cloudflare in here, right? It's a slightly different use case. Cloudflare is another managed offering, you know, not as huge as, say, like an AWS, but you can, you know, install an application and then basically say publish this thing, and it will go ahead and publish it on a worker, and it will run your code on those Cloudflare workers. And they claim no cold starts because of how, you know, they're built on a CDN and things like that. I have no experience, so I'm not going to comment on it. But again, this thing that comes up a lot, you'll see a lot, is that term of cold starts, because it is, I think, maybe a fear when people get into it. There's a whole bunch of other serverless platforms and offerings out there. Netlify also has the Netlify Functions. So if you're into that, we'll put a link to Netlify Functions. And it's a good segue into the difference between serverless and functions as a service. Do you want to kick us off?
No, go for it. This is all you. Right. I'm still confused with this. So I'll appreciate like your breakdown.
Absolutely. So you know, serverless again is the overarching term. And I want to say serverless functions is sort of a subset of how we think about serverless. Again, serverless just basically means you don't own or care about managing the server, again, as we see with serverless compute tiers with databases and things like that. That's not basically that's still an entire application, still an entire database. It's just managing like when the thing is active and not, right? And kind of serving that thing. Serverless functions takes that a step further. So it's a further abstraction of a serverless compute as a whole application versus running part of an application. So think about, like you said before, you have a web application that maybe, you know, serves you know, images or stores images or lets you search for those images. This is basically taking an application and only part of that application and basically using deploying that thing as a function. So if you've ever written code, you know, you're writing in Python or Go, there's the concept of a function, mm-hmm. right? You're writing some piece of code that does some particular task yep. very well. You can actually put that into a functions as a service platform and have that sit behind the API call. So basically, you could have a whole bunch of things that are part that make up sort of the guts of what an application yeah. does, have them behind APIs, and just have a very lightweight shim of a front end that kind of calls these things. Okay. Right. So your functions are quite literally sitting back there. But in concept, they're still little tiny pieces of compute that still run somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so they're functions as a service. So I would say a subset of serverless because it is okay. a piece of compute running on a non-managed piece of hardware mm-hmm. compute server somewhere. So it is a serverless. So you'll often hear the term serverless functions or functions as a service. And really that's what it means is that you're breaking up an application. And it's a newer concept than even serverless, I would say. And it's really aimed at sort of more the developer than it yeah. is a bigger term like at the CIO level. And Lambda actually is a good example, right? Lambda is used as sort of a function platform. Azure has the Azure functions, mm-hmm. specifically Google Cloud Functions, Oracle Cloud Functions. Yep. They're all out there. And so it's basically application logic, but it's all stateless compute okay. in the sense that it runs somewhere else. And it's more in line with event-driven architecture. We had this on here as a bullet point. Mm-hmm. But basically, event-driven means that, like, say you have a message queue or an HTTP mm-hmm. Gateway, and you get a request or a message comes in over your queue. That is an event that you can react to, and that event can trigger a function.
Okay,
and it goes and calls like some function as a service somewhere. So hopefully how I understand it, and hopefully that makes sense for you.
It does, right? I think when you're talking about how the application is broken down, I was able to draw parallels to how we talk about microservices applications running on Kubernetes, right? Like you have a pod which does one thing and one thing really well, and then you have these service objects that allow you to talk between these things. But then in case of Kubernetes, you always have these things running. Whereas I think when you broke it down into functions, you have these in front of and behind an API gateway and only triggered when it's needed, when that component of that application was needed. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say like in the AWS like realm of things, mm-hmm. the Fargate mm-hmm. maps better to the general serverless term and AWS Lambda maps better to the functions term.
Okay.
It's not exact, but I would say like if you are familiar with the AWS environment, yeah, then you're probably more familiar with it.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway, so there's a whole bunch of links, show notes that we'll put there. Let's move on to Knative.
Yep. And Knative has been around for a while, right? Like, again, we heard Knative in like 2017, 18, I think, if I remember correctly. But I looked at Knative when it was still starting up and I was like, okay, that's another option of running serverless. I thought my understanding at that point was it's just people trying to use buzzwords and come up with a new open source project. But spending the last week learning more about the Knative project, that they have made a lot of progress actually helping you run serverless on Kubernetes. I think one of the things that you asked at the beginning of this podcast, right? Like the vendor lock-in component where you are tied to a specific vendor, and we yep. hinted at Knative, but yeah, Knative basically allows you to run your own serverless platform for your applications on any Kubernetes cluster. So it provides you that same level of orchestration capabilities as it's that you need to make your application vendor agnostic or cloud agnostic. I think looking at the Knative project itself, it is broken down into three major themes, themes being serving, eventing, and functions. Again, I think from the research that I've done, I'll spend a lot of time on serving and then maybe a bit on eventing as well. But Knative serving is that serverless capability, right? So it defines mm-hmm. what is it? Like Knative serving defines a set of objects or custom resources or CRDs or customer resource definitions that are used to define and control how serverless workloads behave on your Kubernetes cluster. Again, this can run on any Kubernetes cluster, as we have killed that point to death, but it provides the same set of CRDs and resources for you to use. The first one being a service CRD. This is not Kubernetes service. It's just a Knative service, which basically manages the whole lifecycle of your workload. So you define a Knative service, and as part of that definition, you specify things like configuration and revisions. So configuration is your application configuration, and revisions help you define different levels or different versions of your application itself. So you might have V1, V2, V3, and then you have a different CRD called a route. And using the serving CRD, you can specify, okay, route, you can do traffic routing or traffic, traffic routing. So you can define in the route object that 20% of my traffic needs to go to revision V1, 50% goes through version V2, and then the remaining 30% has to go to V3. And again, revisions are immutable, right? So if you make any change to a revision through the configuration object, that creates a new revision. So revisions actually give you that immutable thing, so you can test out very specific versions of your code, see how users react to it, and then if you wanted to kill a revision, you can, and then just promote or send all your traffic to a specific revision. All of that is built in. All of these capabilities are built in and can be defined with a simple YAML file. So gotcha. If you break down the architecture, right? So you have a Knative service. Okay, I'm going to use my hands a lot. So if you're listening to the audio podcast, maybe check out our YouTube channel. Shameless plug, right? But you have a Knative service box at the top. And then let's imagine there is a route box on the left side of it, and then a configuration box on the right side of it, below the Knative service. So you have user traffic coming in from the route section. And then, as we said, right, the route helps you define traffic routing. So you can send specific versions of revisions, specific traffic to specific revision versions. And then each revision, and this is how it ties back to Kubernetes resources, each revision deploys a Kubernetes deployment object. So now I guess we are in the familiar territory of Kubernetes deployments and Kubernetes objects. So when you have a revision, it points to a deployment, and that's how you can have multiple revisions mapping to multiple deployments. And each deployment will have application pods. Again, this will depend on how much traffic you are expecting. So it can scale to zero, or it can scale to, say, 100 if you have a lot of traffic coming in for that specific revision. Since it's a deployment, it should have a pod. So you will have a pod with a couple of containers. One container is your user application, your application code. And then they have a special component called Kubeproxy, which is basically responsible for keeping a track of the number of requests that are coming into the pod. So it basically works with another Knative component called the autoscaler. So autoscaler is responsible for looking at this Kubeproxy metrics. And if it's reaching a point where it needs to spin up more pods in that deployment object or increase that replica count for that deployment object, it will automatically do that. So without the user getting involved, the autoscaler component looks at those metrics, spins up more pods if you're getting new traffic. So that's how the autoscaling component works in Knative. But I think one of the things that we discussed when we are talking about serverless is the actual scale to zero. So let's talk about how scale to zero works. So scale to zero is actually achieved because, like, okay, if you don't have any requests and your application is like you don't have any pods or deployment objects, how does autoscaler know when to spin it up? Because right now autoscaler only looks at the metrics already in your pod to scale up replicas. So Knative has another component called activator. So activator, what does it do? It looks for, so if you don't have any deployment objects, activator is the object that looks at those revisions. And then if a specific revision is getting a lot of requests, it will talk to autoscaler and ask it to spin up those deployment objects or spin up those application pods. So this is how everything works. So scale to zero, your application can be dead. If you get new user requests in, activator knows about that. It spins up at least one instance, and then from that point on, autoscaler takes it over and then maybe spins it up to, let's say, 50 pods for the amount of traffic that you're expecting. So hopefully that helped kind of show the flow that Knative uses to serve user traffic between different versions using the configuration object and the scale to zero and scale to many capabilities. Hopefully that helped.
Yeah, it does. And I think, like, if you're interested in what Knative and sort of Kata can do mm-hmm. and help you accomplish, it is quite an interesting topic and does connect with the overall serverless topic, because, you know, even if you aren't sort of using it by itself, you can connect it to other services that we mentioned, like Azure Functions mm-hmm. and whatnot. So
yeah, I think I do want to talk about Kata a bit as well. I know we covered Knative, so Kata, I think this is one of my, I guess to use a weird term, but this is one of the beefs that I have with Kata. Is even the KubeCon talk that Kata did was named serverless. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with serverless. Kata in all its, like, Kata stands for Kubernetes Event Driven Autoscaling. So Ryan, the example that you use, right? Like, you're monitoring your messaging queue for events or HTTP queues. Kata does that for autoscaling decisions. So how is it different than HPA or horizontal pod autoscaling? Horizontal pod autoscaling just looks at your CPU and memory metrics. So how much CPU and memory your pod is actually consuming. If they're getting overworked, it will go ahead and spin up those additional pods that are needed. This is how HPA works. But Kata, the Kubernetes event-driven autoscaling project, actually runs on your Kubernetes cluster. It uses HPA as that orchestration layer, but it allows you to plug into different sources. So it will monitor, let's say, your MongoDB cluster, or it will monitor your Kafka cluster. It will look for those events and entries being generated. And to anticipate the traffic coming in, it will go ahead and spin up those pods. So it helps you scale not just on your CPU and memory and what's happening right now, but it can help you anticipate additional user traffic and spin up your application components or your application pods. And I think looking at their documentation, they support like 55 different event sources, including things like Prometheus and RabbitMQ and SQS or PostgreSQL. Again, a lot of things, but yeah, it basically looks at things that are happening and then gets your pod ready to accept that user traffic. They do have a couple of different objects. One is called scaled object. Again, these are the resources that will spin up your pods and spin up more resources. But I want to talk about scaled job. So if you have long running jobs, right? So if you have a task in your application that takes an hour, if the metric is gone, like the number of new requests that are coming in is gone, Kata might also scale down your application. You don't obviously want that when your application is actively processing some data. That's where a scaled job comes in, and it helps you handle those long running executions. So if you have, it instead of spinning up pods, it spins up Kubernetes jobs, and then it helps you handle those long running executions. So that's a quick pitch on Kata, and hopefully that is a project that you can check out and helps you in your day-to-day life. But yeah, those were the serverless projects that I think we wanted to discuss today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are some really good projects. And I know, I think, can you use them together, or are they sort of like competing a little bit in terms of what their purposes are?
I think competing, right? Because even Knative has its own autoscaler called KPA, Knative Pod Autoscaler, and not Horizontal Pod Autoscaler. So HPA, so Horizontal Pod Autoscaler, can never really scale down to zero. It will always be one and more. KPA and Kata can actually help you scale down to zero and then use the HPA mechanism to scale your application up when needed.
Got it. Very cool. Very cool stuff. And of course, we will link to both of those projects, and if you're interested in how to get started, as well as everything else we talked about. This brings us to the part in our show where we ask ChatGPT a question about the topic we're talking about today. And today we asked a question. We asked ChatGPT to come up with a question, mm-hmm. and then we asked it to answer itself. And the question was, if serverless computing were a superhero, who would it be and why? You may have your own answer to this, but what ChatGPT says is, serverless computing were a superhero, it would be the Flash. Ooh. Just as the Flash can move at incredible speeds without wasting energy, serverless computing allows developers to run their code without having to worry about managing and scaling servers, thus minimizing the energy consumption and cost. Additionally, the Flash's superhuman speed enables him to quickly respond to any situation, just as serverless computing can instantly respond to changes in demand and scale resources accordingly. Overall, both serverless computing and the Flash have a similar goal: to quickly and efficiently get the job done with minimal waste.
Nice. I think I do have an answer for this. Like, when we were doing the podcast, I was like, okay, if it was a superhero, I think it will be Superman. Or maybe for that reason, like any other superhero. But the reason I say that is, as soon as there is a crime happening, Superman actually has to go inside a phone booth, get changed, and then respond to the crime.
It's got a cold start problem.
Come on.
I like it.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Unless he's already dressed. Yeah,
if he's already going around, have a bomb stat ready to go or a snapshot available. But if he's sitting down and doing the Clark Kent work, then yeah, maybe it needs some cold start time.
Awesome. Oh, man. All right. Well, hopefully this was a useful episode to you. Yeah. I know Bhavan and I had fun putting it together and sort of digging into some of the topics and technologies that we often hear and the buzzword serverless in general. Hopefully it clears things up, gives you some things to look into. If you have feedback or questions, please reach out to us in any form that you feel is necessary, DM, email, anything like that. And we have some cool guests coming up in the show in the future, but that brings us to the end of today's episode. I'm Ryan.
I'm Bhavan.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Kubernetes Bytes. Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.